Hey, Dr. Chris, welcome to the new podcast.
Great to be here with you.
Yeah, I would say welcome back because we've done this before in other formats, but this is the first time on this show and I'm excited for it. It's always nice to connect with somebody else who has a somewhat similar background with mental health and can relate to some things, because I think you can relate to feeling a little different than others sometimes when trying to fit into conversations, and I can too. We're going to talk about mental health today. We're going to talk about a naturopathic approach and like how things like diet and lifestyle really play a role in our mental state and our mental health, and how you got on that path is similar to how I got on mine in a way. And we've talked about your story before, and that could be its whole hour-long episode, so I'll probably keep it a little abbreviated. We've gone into details in the past, but I guess just first, if you could share, what was your career before? Because I know you had a pretty intense professional career before going to naturopathic medicine route. And what happened that kind of changed your trajectory?
Yes. So, yeah, I haven't always been a naturopathic doctor. And my journey to becoming one was because of my own struggles with my mental health, which included bulimia, anxiety, depression, and then bipolar disorder type 1, because I got put on medication and spun out of control into a psychotic event. And those are the sort of the top four diagnoses. And then that also includes 3 suicide attempts. So what happened was, so I was working in the corporate world and I was the head of marketing for HSBC Asset Management in Canada, which is an investment management firm. And I reported to the CEO and I was wearing this mask every single day that, hey, I've got it all together on the outside, but on the inside, I was struggling with myself, with my place in the world, just with even being on the planet with you. And so what happened was I had this suicide attempt and it left me in a coma with kidney failure. I was on dialysis and I was told I would need a kidney transplant. And I can tell you, when I came out of that coma, I certainly wasn't happy. Like, I was even more depressed that I was still here. And I couldn't even look the ER doctor in the eye when she so joyfully came in the room to like, hey, I saved your life. And I'm just like, yeah, I didn't ask you to. Didn't ask you to do that. So anyway, I was at the bottom as far as you can be down that hole. And a friend gave me a book to read because I had a lot of time on my hands. I was in the hospital at that time for 3 months. And this book was by Marianne Williamson called The Return to Love. And there was a quote about surrender in the book. And a key word was the word love, which, I kid you not, was a foreign concept to me. What the heck is that? And I didn't, and I can tell you for myself and for all of my patients that I work with, we are the furthest from love that you can possibly be when you're wanting to end your life. So therein lied the light bulb moment for me. I was like, okay, I got to figure out another way to navigate this journey that I'm on, because the way I'm doing it was psychotropic med upon psychotropic med. I was on 5. And wow. Let me clarify that. I'm not anti-medication. I'm minimum dose for maximum benefit for the shortest duration of time, number one. And number two, hey, if they help you, great. But they weren't helping me. That's a really important point people need to understand. I wasn't better on them. So anyway, so that led me to then find a naturopathic doctor and then get better. And here I am, essentially. That's the journey.
Wow. And I can't imagine. So just my own background context a little bit. I've struggled with like suicidal depression for on and off for a lot of my life until pretty recently, and recently being maybe 5 or 6 years. And I never made it quite as far as you did down that path, but I can kind of imagine that waking up, not really remembering what happened for a minute or knowing what's going on or where you're at or whatever, and then all of a sudden like recalling and being like, shit. Because then you're in a real bad spot. Like, then you're way worse off than you were before. Depressed, except now you're really sick. You're in the hospital. You have all these medical problems and you have some cheerful person standing over you excited. And yeah, I can imagine, because there's things about, you mentioned when you're suicidal that you're the furthest from love. And I think that there's a lot of things that people don't realize about that level of depression. And like when suicidal ideation is present, I think that I've had a lot of well-meaning people try to talk to me about it. And they just don't get it. Mm. And the relief of not being successful wouldn't be relief in the moment. Now you can look back on it and be like, man, I'm really glad that didn't work out. But in the moment, I can imagine the frustration and also just the like God, I can't even do that. Like,
exactly.
I couldn't even do that successfully.
Which fed, I was just going to interject there just to say, which fed into the core limiting belief is I'm worthless, which we know, you and I both know, stems from trauma.
Yeah.
And I want to just mention something that you touched on. What the suicidal ideation part for me was the most agonizing phase. So whether it's just, I was in that phase for so long, Michael, like the constant beration within my head from this inner critic that was, and then that even said, you don't even have the courage to do this. Like, you're such a chicken. You can't even take your own life. Like, you're such a chicken. So it's almost like this other part of me was like, okay.
Which is objectively ridiculous because it's terrifying.
Yeah. And then
like,
the other
like part from of me, a, from an objective point of view, that voice is so off point. Because that is not like a easy thing.
No, no, it's so not easy. And that's why I dedicate my book Beyond the Label to all the souls that we've lost to this struggle. Mm-hmm. Because we lose people every single day. James Greenblatt said, who's an integrative psychiatrist, said that by the year 2030, which is not that far away, like when he said this was like 2010, seemed like a far, far away. Now it's only 5 years away. A person will attempt to take their life every second. You know, globally. Yeah.
And it's like, what are we doing? What are we doing that there aren't, that's not part of the natural world. That's not a regular occurrence. Like, you can't track that in other animals. Like, it's not a thing that happens. Like, we're not programmed to do that. That is the opposite of our programming. So how messed up of a, like, everything world have we created to where that's the solution? And mm-hmm. that's where people are. And it's just tragic. And maybe we could talk a little about, you didn't have this background in naturopathic medicine. You're on all these drugs, which, man, I can't imagine. I never took medication. And I'm not like throwing medication entirely under the bus. It's got its place for the right people at the right time and the right ways of being used. I don't know if five of them at once is ever the right time, but I'm not I'm not a doctor. I've never taken them really. I've taken Xanax a little bit, like, I don't know the non-brand name for that, but, and that's an anti-anxiety, not an antidepressant. But you didn't know these things. And then you read the book, you started to pick up like some ideas and, oh, this is a, there's all these things that influence how I feel. If I exercise, if I go outside, and these are things you don't want to hear when you're super depressed, by the way. So well-meaning people out there, if somebody's struggling, don't just bust into their life all of a sudden and just tell them they need to go for a walk. There's ways to do it. But anyways, I just want to say that because I had a lot of well-meaning people tell me like, you just need to go to the gym. And I was like, dude, I can't even do the laundry.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but started to look into these things. And what factors did you find? Like, what did you find first? Like, whether it's diet or nutrition or lifestyle, or what were kind of your first things that you learned and you actually implemented them and you were like, hey, I feel a little bit better than I did.
Mm-hmm. So the first thing was I went to two different doctors. One was a naturopathic doctor and the other was an orthomolecular psychiatrist, medical
wow.
doctor. Yeah. Named Abraham Hoffer. So he's quite famous in Canada. And so what moved the needle was first and foremost was nutrition. So I had a lot of cracks in my nutritional foundation. I was still engaging in bulimic tendencies. And this is another mental illness that's clouded with a lot of shame and a lot of stigma, as is bipolar disorder. So Dr. Hoffer and Dr. Chan, my naturopathic doctor, built in supplements. Now, I want to acknowledge that supplementation is no different, in my opinion, than taking a pharmaceutical medication. It's just that it's more naturally derived to support the building blocks of your body so you can make the neurotransmitters that you need to make. Now, I was a vegetarian, but I was hardly eating any meat. Sorry, of course, I'm not eating any meat. Pardon me. I was hardly eating any vegetables on my vegetarian diet. I was a carbitarian. Pastitarian, sugaritarian more so.
Yeah.
And what we want to understand is the main neurotransmitter people talk about when it comes to depression, anxiety is serotonin. And that's derived from an essential amino acid that we cannot make on our own. We got to get it from the outside in. And I was deficient in that. And not one doctor in the 15 years prior ever asked me what I was eating. Including the naturopathic doctors. Okay, so I'm not saying, so this is what's so important is you can't just throw, we're about root cause medicine. So you can't just throw supplements at people.
Yeah.
Right? And anyway, so that didn't move the needle. So what happened was I started with the supplements, didn't really make any changes in my nutrition whatsoever, but the supplements kind of buoyed me up, if you will. And I was still taking all those medications. But the difference was I had a year where I was free of depression, Michael, and that had not happened. That had not happened in the 15 years prior. Not, I couldn't say to you that I had a full year with zero depression. So that was eye-opening to me. And I'm like, okay, there's something to this, something to this. And then I had to work on all those other pieces. Because remember, it's physical, mental, emotional, spiritual. And what was eye-opening to me was when I did slip up in taking the supplements after a year, because it's tedious, right? Mm-hmm. It's tedious to take medication.
There's certain stuff I've been taking for probably 6 or 7 years now. And yeah, it is. I struggle with it. I take the things every day, but not as many times or not in the right. I always forget. It's tough. I also have ADD. So then it's already 6 p.m. and I didn't eat lunch.
Yes. So I think I have a touch of ADHD. Never die. I'm sure I would have been diagnosed with that if I had been looked at that way. Anyway, so my point being that when I fell off the supplement wagon, guess what happened?
Regressed.
Yes, another depression. So that showed me that I wasn't really solving anything by taking the supplements. And at this point, I had been weaned off the medication. So now I'm just left to my own devices, if you will. And I'm not making these things on my own because I'm not eating properly. That was really important. I really want to emphasize that to people. So one little guidebook I created is the Essential Diet Eating for Mental Health. So then I continued to work on that. And then I had to address my thoughts and my emotions and how I behaved and reacted in the world, my stress. There's just so many dials you can turn. Mm-hmm. But the beautiful thing is, and the encouraging thing for people that are listening, is that it's just one step in one direction. It will move the needle and propel you forward. It really will.
I like it. It's described, I don't know, remember, there's a book, I think it's titled this, The Upward Spiral.
No.
I don't remember, I think it's the title of a book, but I didn't read the whole book. I read parts of it. And part of it was that if you look at, here's the 47 things that influence your depression and that you can make changes on, that feels overwhelming. But if you make one or two of the changes, and you feel a little bit better, doing more changes feels less overwhelming. So it can create a snowball effect. And so that little dietary change that helps you feel a little bit less depressed helps you do the walk in the afternoon, which helps you do the dreaded social connection, which helps you do, which so then, yeah. And there's that carrot, that motivation, because not feeling really depressed when you felt really depressed for a long time is super cool. Like it's, and strange, like weird and scary. And I didn't trust it for a while, but well, there's like a motivation there, right? But it feels like you're in a different movie. Like it's like a, I use the black and white to color like analogy, like it just flips. And so you've really made this your, that's how I found you and your work is I found your book looking for myself for like help. And you came up and people referred, they knew what I had gone through and they were like, oh, you need to talk to her. And so you really used this, I don't want to say, I cringe when people like suggest that, oh, everything is a good thing you went through that hell so that you could do this thing and you turned your, whatever. It's fine if people want to say things like that, but I don't think it's ever good that somebody goes through that kind of hell, but you did.
Yeah.
And now you're using it as like your own experience has shaped what you're doing professionally. And you have two books, right?
Yeah.
When did the first book come out?
2017.
Okay. And that's like the foundations, right? That's the
Beyond the Label. Yeah.
Yeah. Beyond the Label. And it's a naturopathic approach for mental health. And you spoke all over the country, world at this. You were in Europe fairly recently, weren't you? Yeah. Did you have fun?
Yes.
Yeah. It looked like it. I saw some mutual friends in pictures with you.
Yeah.
And so how has that journey been? Did you hesitate to share some about your story at all for a while? Because I know I did. I never just talked about it like this out in the open. So would people be like, why are you so interested in mental health? And you go, oh, no reason. Or how did you answer that?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. God. Yeah, that shame. Because I had a psychiatrist tell me once, oh, Chris, don't let anybody know you've got this. So I was like, the bipolar disorder. Oh.
People are scared of bipolar.
Very, very. And I really want to, first of all, say that there's two types. So one is type one is with psychosis, which is what I have experienced. And I really want to hone in on that word experience. This is an experience. This is a state that we can get to. This other word that really gets me is normal. Because I've come to understand that a severely dysregulated nervous system can result in these wide ranges of emotional experience, which include psychosis on the one extreme end and suicidal ideation on the other extreme end. And therein is a description of bipolar disorder, type one. For me, I lived in so much shame with that, so much shame. And so I was private about that until the book came out in 2017. And when I published, when you hit print, I had a panic attack, Michael. I was like, oh my God, what have I done? My career's over. But really, I wanted to write that book because there isn't a lot of people writing about it from the natural perspective. There's one of the references that people often resource for bipolar disorder is this book called The Unquiet Mind by Kay Redfield Jamison, which was, I believe, published in the 80s. So I wanted to provide something a little more current about and presenting this root cause, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual approach. Because when you get diagnosed with bipolar disorder, you get the message, number one, this is bad. Number two, you got to take this medication for the rest of your life, and that's the only solution. Oh, and by the way, in 40 years or 20, 30, 40 years, that medication's going to wreck your liver. So there's that. And I'm like, that doesn't really sound like a solution to me. So anyway, and it's not commonly accepted by the medical community, what I've just said, that you can live medication free or medication less with bipolar disorder. And I'm living proof that actually you can.
Wow. I don't know a lot about the differences. That's interesting. And I've heard a lot, even within the more naturally minded therapy and trauma world, that bipolar is one of the more difficult conditions to manage without medication. Mm-hmm. And there's now less shame around it, like as people are starting to understand it. Maybe that's just me getting more involved in the world of people who don't have shame about it. But I think it frightens people because they can't control it. Not the person who has it, the people around them. They can't control it. Like the behavior to them is unpredictable and it's scary to people and they don't know how to relate to it. And so it's about them being uncomfortable. Okay. Just like nobody wants to be around somebody that's grieving because that makes them really uncomfortable, or they want you to feel better or cheer up because they're uncomfortable, et cetera, et cetera. I think bipolar is difficult in that regard, that it makes people uncomfortable because they don't know how to relate. And so fast forward, and you've learned so much, a wealth of information, and now you've written books, you've been speaking, you've been working with people and helping patients and teaching other practitioners, and you've had study groups and retreats, I believe, and all kinds of things. And what has been, I know the book outlines a whole lot, and what are some of the biggest needle movers now that you have this, not just your own personal experience, but you've been educating, you've been working with people, you've witnessed kind of a larger, it's not, what is it, A equals one, it's A equals a whole bunch of people now. So is it different for everybody, or are there some common, you mentioned physical, you're thinking of the exercise, you're thinking of the supplements, you're thinking of the diet, you're thinking of the biochemistry, the neurotransmitters, that kind of stuff. And then there's the mental, the emotional, and the spiritual. Where are the biggest gaps that you've seen, or where are the biggest, needle movers for people? I guess so those would be the two questions I would ask.
Yeah. So the biggest gaps for people are connecting to that spiritual piece. So if we just visualize a bullseye, how it's got the rings, right? Yeah. The center ring is the spirit, then you've got mental, emotional, and the outer ring is the physical. But that's fluid. It's not like there's silos. And so everything is affecting the other. So they're all important. And like I said, really, we just want to start where we can with what we're able to do. And most people start on that outer ring, which is that physical level. So with respect to that, I just want people to understand that there's three macro systems in your body, three sort of big systems. So you've got your neurotransmitters, which we mentioned. And of that, there's seven key ones that we want to have our eyeballs on. Then there's the hormones, which we also want to have our eyeballs on. And then we have the organs of detoxification and our immune system. All three of those, if you were my patient, my first, when I'm assessing you, is I'm considering, okay, which of these macro systems is the really the big one that I need to hone in on here? And the reality is, in my case, it was all three. Because what I didn't mention, if we talk about root cause medicine, it's when do things begin? For me, I actually have to go back to that in utero experience. That's how far back we have to go. And in some patients, we have to go even further back to consider intergenerational trauma. In my case, there was an intergenerational trauma piece, but we'll just stick with my biological mother. So I'm adopted. And so what that means is that I wasn't bathed in a lot of happy hormones when my biological mother was pregnant, because one of our teachers is Gabor Maté, who talks about the fact that a woman has to make up a decision about whether to keep a child or not. Research shows that there's going to be more cortisol, which is the stress hormone, coursing through her veins, which is going to impact the developing brain structures of the fetus. So I come into the world, and now we'll fast forward to age 13, where I developed acne, had a lot of really bad acne. And what was the prescription of the day at the time? Tetracycline, which is an antibiotic. So I took that for 6 months to a year. Now you and I both know that disrupts the gut microbiome. And then came the eating disorder. That came first. And what was driving all of that was the overachieving tendency, because of the sense of lack I felt from this unworthiness of not being wanted, this faulty belief that I wasn't wanted. I then strove to be this overcompensated, to be this high achiever in the world. So the biggest thing really for me, so yes, the nutrition is super important, but it's what are the nature of the thoughts you're thinking, right? And are they based in fear or love, stress, or calmness? And when you mentioned about bipolar disorder, people being uncomfortable, is because they're approaching the person from a place of fear. There might be love, obviously, underneath that concern and care for their loved one, friend, whoever it may be. But what's in front of that love is fear. And at the end of the day, it all comes down to energy and vibration. And if you're approaching someone from a place of fear, you're going to be pushing more your nervous system into that sympathetic state, which is going to drive the cortisol train higher. And it's not going to go well. Not going to go well.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. And I'm adopted as well, which we've talked about on previous podcasts. So I was also not bathed in whatever you're supposed to be bathed in. And my nervous system also got wired for fear, alert. And unsafety. Yeah. And yeah. I didn't know until I was probably close to 40 years old when I was in Compassionate Inquiry with Gabor, and he shared some statistics about adoptees of exponential increased rates of addiction and alcoholism and suicide and depression and eating disorders and insert any
mental health
trauma related mental health issue. And adoptee ADD also 10x the norm, and which he proposes is a trauma response in and of itself, or that experiencing developmental trauma affects a developing brain in a way that increases the chance that you develop ADHD, which makes a lot of sense given my moderate understanding of neuroscience. It was so justifying, though. I don't know, not justifying, validating.
Yes, that's the right word.
To find that out. That's the right word, not justifying, validating, to find that out, that because you don't know that. And so you're the broken thing.
That's right.
Right? Why do I have all these problems? I suck because I insert reason why. So then I'm going to starve myself or binge eat or drink or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to feel better than I do. You feel crappy all the time inherently because you suck, not because something happened to you. And there's all these explanations as to why. So it was really validating for me to learn that about adoptees. And now it enabled me to have a lot more compassion for myself, mm-hmm. which shifts everything in my experience. So I bet you run into that too. Can you speak to that? Like people who come work with you or people who you've encountered who are struggling with mental health issues and they're seeking natural approaches. So they obviously, they have a desire to get better or feel better.
They're sitting across the table.
They care. They're not where you were in that hospital. They're not where I've been, at least not in that moment. They're in a state where they're like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do these things. I want to get better. I want to take action. Can you speak to the importance of that aspect of like self-compassion and what kind of shift that can have in the, not just the mental health healing process, but I think this goes for anybody working with any kind of chronic disease or, you know, healing, I'll put healing in quotes, but any sort of healing. Can you speak to the importance of that?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to say one thing as you were sharing that there's a quote that, and I don't know who it's attributed to, which is adoption is the only trauma where the adoptee is expected to be grateful.
I've heard it as well.
Yeah, it's very powerful because, and I'm not, and it's, and I am actually, I am grateful.
It can be both things. Like, yeah, I've heard people get very defensive and angry about that quote as well. And like, it's both things. Like, you could be in a better situation than you would have been in. And you got dropped into that situation with a lot of very difficult wiring and programming. And that, at least when we were born, I don't know about Canada, but in the States, adoptive parents are now required to do a lot of counseling and therapy, and they're educated a lot more. And there's a lot more known about this. Where I was small, it was like, here you go. Here's your baby.
Here's your bundle of joy.
Here's your baby. That's going to be a really difficult baby to raise. Good luck. And then that was it. Like that was the, so that's so
Anyway, no, it's just an interesting thing to tangent to consider. But to answer the question, so just like love was a foreign concept to me, so is compassion. Compassion was a foreign concept. So Kristen Neff is a person who's done a lot of work on self-compassion. I encourage people to search out her work. And a beautiful quote she has is that, you know, answering this question, why self-compassion? And it's so important because its driver is love, not fear. And when we're, another important chemical is oxytocin. And this is a very powerful neurotransmitter that is, I think, under acknowledged in mental health. And so the, so just shifting the question, so a practical thing people can take home today is to shift the question from what's wrong with me or what's the problem with me to what's good for me in this moment? What's truly going to be in service of myself in this moment? It could be staying under the covers. It could be going outside, whatever it is for you. But love is the driver here. And this is what's really important point. So what, and again, if you don't know where to start, if you're like me and you didn't understand those two words, love or compassion, and you didn't know where to start, you just simply start with what's possible for you. Like for me, it was simply choosing an apple over a cookie. That was it.
Which you isn't know? Always as easy as it sounds.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So it's a really important piece, though, this compassion, because kindness and gentleness and acceptance and understanding and all of those pieces are important. And again, you're the furthest from love that you can possibly be if you're wanting to end your life. It's not kind to you, right? So you want to start treating yourself in a gentler, more accepting way, whether it's the way you're talking to yourself in your head. That was a big one for me. You know, what a key question is, what are you saying to yourself that you're not actually willing to say out loud? Right? And I was saying a lot of things that I would never say.
Things you wouldn't say to somebody else. Like I've heard that. I'm not a like big, harsh inner critic person myself. That's not my struggle. I've worked with people who are. And the thing that therapists always say is, would you talk to your daughter or husband or friend or parent? Well, some would probably, but put in person that like you would never ever in a million years talk like that to. And a lot of people can be much harsher on themselves. And I think that I saw that pattern a lot when I was working with people with chronic illness, not my mental illness. I was not doing that with functional health coaching. I was doing more chronic health conditions, but that pattern was always there. Not always, but most of the time. Like, how's your last week been? I didn't, I screwed up. I was stupid and I ate this thing and I was dumb and I didn't take my supplements and I can't do this right. And I was lazy and I didn't go to the gym. And if those are the words that are coming out, the ones that are inside are like, that's the filtered version usually, right?
But I want to explain why this is so important for people to get.
Yeah.
Because your thoughts, whether you say them out loud or you're just saying them inside the four walls of your head, your thoughts create neuropeptides. Neuropeptides are chemical messengers that speak to the glands in your body that produce hormones, one of which is the adrenal gland that produces cortisol. Cortisol will then feed back up to your nervous system and tell it sympathetic, parasympathetic, danger or safe. And if the thoughts are based in this critical side or inner critic, inner cheerleader, if they're over here in the sympathetic, then the body thinks that, okay, I need to continue on this spiral. And then cortisol is more of an inflammatory molecule, which will then inhibit our ability to heal in a very simplistic manner. And so it's not about, so this is called psychoneuroimmunology. Your thoughts affect your physiology. And this is why it's important to bring awareness to what is the nature of what's going on in here, in this building that I'm in all the time. And I'm not saying, and this is why I think I struggled, Michael, for probably 20 years longer than I needed to, because I was so resistant to this idea that I've just explained. Essentially, change your thoughts, change your life. If you had said that to me, I would have rolled my eyes at you and walked out of the room and said, that's a load of hoo-hoo, like forget it. Because I felt like you were implying that I was intentionally causing my problems purpose. And two words I haven't used to describe this, these two aspects of ourselves, sympathetic, parasympathetic scientific terms, is also ego versus soul, right? So ego versus soul. So we have the egoic mind, but we also have a spirit. Or an intuition, or a soul, if you will. These are words that people don't feel comfortable using. But another way to describe it is that you got two voices. This one's speaking really loud, and this other one is whispering. Yeah? So when I was able to accept this, this scientifically proven model by Candace Pert, who wrote Molecules of Emotion way back in the 90s. I was then able to just stay neutral then with my thoughts. I wasn't able to go, because I felt like I was putting whipping cream on a pile of bologna. If I said, my thought is I am unworthy, then just to say I am worthy, that to me didn't feel right because I believe that I'm unworthy. But the key thing with psychoneuroimmunology is that nowhere does it say you have to believe the thought. But simply saying it creates that cascade in a different way. That I was talking about, neuropeptides to hormones, et cetera. And eventually the irony with it all, if you'll just try it on, if you just work with it, you actually do feel better, which is the beauty. But for me, it was very hard. So I would just go neutral. So the neutral statement with that example of I am unworthy is simply just I am. And we don't fill in the blank. We're super descriptive and critical, I think, often of ourselves. Why? And where does that come from? And that gets into the wiring and blah, 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 the programming. Because we're all programmed, right? It's just a computer. We're all programmed by the people who not only raise us, but the environment, the teachers, the coaches, the friends.
Social media. I can't imagine. I'm so grateful that I grew up before there was social media. Like I can't even fathom having everything I say or do or whatever of everything, of everyone, everywhere. All when you're in like junior high, high school, like that would have been... I don't know if I would have made it out or there. Like, have you seen the book Anxiety, the Anxiety Generation, I think it's called?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it, but I've heard of it.
I've read some excerpts and then I talked to somebody who is an anxiety focused therapist and they have read it and they were telling me about it. And the statistics on mental diagnosed anxiety disorders now in kids and people under 20 is terrifying. Like it's like high enough that it'll be difficult to have a functional society because everyone's so anxious. And with girls, it's three times the increase as it has been with boys. And they were able to line up studies that showed a linear relationship between anxiety disorders and time spent on social media.
Yeah, I agree. Here's the thing. I mentioned to you how by the year 2030, that we talk about the race of suicide. I've been practicing for 20 years and all I see is the rates going up. So I would be fired. I should be fired, really. Not me personally, but all of us as clinicians, therapists, people who are trying to help people, we're doing something wrong because rates should not be going up. Rates should be going down. And so what's changed drastically in the last 20 years? This technology piece, mm-hmm. right? And this gets overlooked and under acknowledged. And it's a huge piece of the puzzle. And I struggle so bad without social media. I can only imagine, right?
It was not designed. I wrote a post about this the other day, on Facebook. I shared that because there's so many awful things going on. And I got overwhelmed when I was reading about one. And when I shared it, I said that paying really close attention to the current state of the world and current events is an intense practice. And it's not one we're designed to do. Like, our brain is not designed to know everything that's happening everywhere all at the same time, instantaneously, with videos and pictures and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. This is new. This is completely new. And we have these, giving a monkey a supercomputer that tells it literally everything all the time, it's going to go insane. And we're going insane because we can't
process
it fast enough, at all. And then you're supposed to be processing that and doing this. And now with work, you're getting this notification and this email and this phone call and this thing and that thing and this thing. Blah, blah, blah. And then somebody's texting you who wants to hang out and this.
And then your baby's crying.
Yeah. And then they put a screen in front of it. So it's people used to write each other letters to communicate.
Slow it down.
Yeah. So anyways, I know we got to go soon. Yeah. I want to leave the audience with an action step and with how to best connect with you and your work and your books and everything. So if somebody stops as this podcast is over, they got 15 minutes of time.
Okay. So one thing I want to mention, there's two parties involved because I think mental health is a community connection problem. So this first suggestion is for the people who aren't depressed, who know somebody who is, or whatever it is, depression, anxiety, whatever it is they're struggling with, insert label of your choice, to reach out and communicate. And I'll just share a little story about this. So there was a woman whose son, who is 15, I think he was 16, he would not come out of his room and he was struggling, and he would not go to see anybody. Wow. So she was beside herself as a mother. And so all she could think to do, what she thought was completely insignificant, was make him a sandwich every day. She showed up with a sandwich. Sometimes he ate the sandwich. Sometimes he didn't eat the sandwich from the day before. But regardless, she showed up every day with a sandwich. Eventually, this boy turned the corner, was better and going on with his life. His mom asked him, hey, honey, what? Because to her, it was like one day he's well and then he wasn't well for so long. And then the next day he's well. So what happened? What happened? And he said, you know what, mom? It was the sandwich. You showed up. That sandwich represented love for me. And she was like, really? Just that simple sandwich? So I say, share this story to illustrate that the thing that you're doing as a caregiver, you might think is not enough. And yet it makes all the difference to that other person. So show up for your people in whatever way you can. You don't necessarily have to make people sandwiches, but you can show up.
I mean, you can make me sandwiches if you want, but
I would have took a sandwich.
Showing up. Yeah.
Showing up.
Because that's beneficial for the person doing the showing up as well.
The other thing important is not to take it personally. Do you know how many times my friends called and asked and requested and showed up and I refused, but they didn't, they continued. They didn't take it personally. Okay. The person that's struggling doesn't want to be here. So they didn't want to go out. They don't want to be with you, but it's not personal. So please keep showing up. That's for the caregivers. For the person who's listening that might be struggling, I would encourage you to look at just the one thing that you think you can do, whether it's on the nutrition front and the water front or that movement front or perhaps the reading. So what are you feeding yourself if you are able to read or listen to something that might be inspirational for you? There's so many ways that you can create a shift or a change, but understand that you're here for a reason. And a lot of the children, younger generation, is struggling with this concept of purpose. So it is a difficult time when you're coming of age, if you will, 13 to 30. That 17-year period is where I struggled the most. And so It's okay. Yeah, there's no right or wrong. There really isn't. And you can just take a step. And if you're not able to take a step, that's okay. But stay here with us. Stay here with us. Because there is no other you on the planet. And we need you. And you are meant to be here. Because why? Because you're here. You're here. So I know that might sound sort of pie in the sky-ish, but the reality is you might not see your value. And that's what we have to help you see. And everyone has one person. I know we all have. No one is totally an island on themselves. So I'll stop there. But really, just there's so many avenues here to go down. And so on that note, drchristinabiardal.com, right?
We'll have the links down below. Can you say it one more time a little slower? But we'll put them down below in the show notes.
Yeah, drchristinabiardal.com, which is hard to spell. So yeah, we'll just put them down below.
Yeah, the links are down there. And you've got books. Are you doing more retreats?
In October, I usually run one called Mind, Body, Soul.
Yeah, it looked really cool. And you're teaching all over or speaking. And it's just, I'm excited whenever I see you traveling and speaking because there's not enough in the functional medicine world yet around focused on mental health. There's yourself and a few others doing really cool stuff, but there needs to be more. Like you said, we're failing. And I don't mean you're failing and we're up against a tsunami of factors that are causing this problem, but we as humans, and especially as those like in the helping arts or world, we're collectively failing, and there needs to be more done. So thank you so much for what you're doing. Thank you for sharing so openly. I know how powerful it was for me to hear from others who had been like where I was when I was there, and to see them not there gave me this like, oh, this is not a permanent thing, or it doesn't have to be, or like it's possible to not feel like this. And that was huge for me to even believe that, because for a while I didn't even believe that was a thing. And then you're not going to take step one because you're like, what's the point? So thank you for being an example and for providing so many resources and for bringing so many other people along on your own path towards understanding these things and healing. It's really great what you're doing.
Thank you. And yeah, just that's important what you're saying. You're not where you are because there's something necessarily wrong with you. Mm-hmm. It's that there's possibility and there's an explanation for your suffering. So you just got to keep turning over those rocks and looking for the answer because it's there. It's there. And you can fix it. It's, do you know what I'm trying to say? So anyway.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll talk soon. Thanks, Dr. Chris.